This is an excerpt from Welcome to the Machine, pages 81 to 87. Lies are expensive to maintain. Our bodies know when we lie to them or to anyone else, so they must be deadened so they don't betray the nasty game we're playing. But our bodies still know, even when our emotions are numbed and our thoughts confused. We are not machines. We are animals who live and die and breathe and love and hate, who want to rest and enjoy life and who do not wish to be cogs or slaves, who feel pity and do not wish to convert the living to the dead. And so we must be deadened to make sure we do not slide back into our bodies, and then we must be watched so that we do not forget that we are dead. Thus the omniscient God, thus the panopticon, thus the collective terror that identifies democracy with chaos and insecurity. In the modern world, not only must workers and slaves be monitored, lest they become inefficient, read human, read animals, and not only must malcontents, or those who may someday be malcontents, be monitored, lest they rebel, but so too must consumers be monitored, lest they cease to consume. And of course, not only consumers must be monitored, but so too potential consumers. In an industrial system that depends on expanding markets, everyone is and must be a potential customer. The answer? Monitor them all. The word technology comes from the Greek technologia, systematic treatment. The Cambridge Advanced Learner's Dictionary calls technology the study and knowledge of the practical, especially industrial, use of scientific discoveries. Here's another definition, technology, that which separates us from nature, that which leverages power. Years ago, I asked American Indian writer Vine Deloria, author of God is Red, Custer Died for Your Sins, and Red Earth, White Lies, about the difference between civilized and indigenous ways of being. He said that the indigenous way is about seeing that, quote, everything humans experience has value and instructs us in some aspect of life. Because everything is alive and making choices that determine the future, the world is constantly creating itself. And because every moment brings something new, we need to always try to not classify things too quickly. All the data must be considered. And we need to try to find out how the ordinary and extraordinary come together, as they must, in one coherent, comprehensive, mysterious storyline. With the wisdom and time for reflection that old age brings, we may discover unsuspected relationships that make themselves manifest in our consciousness and so come to be understood. In this moral universe, all activities, events, and entities are related. And so it doesn't matter what kind of existence an entity enjoys, whether it's human or otter or star or rock, because the responsibility is always there for it to participate in the continuing creation of reality. Life is not a predatory jungle, red in tooth and claw, as Westerners like to pretend, but is better understood as a symphony of mutual respect in which each player has a specific part to play. We must be in our proper place. We must play our role at the proper moment. So far as humans are concerned, because we came last, we are the younger brothers of the other life forms, and therefore have to learn everything from these other creatures. The real interest of old Indians would then be not to discover the abstract structure of physical reality, but rather to find the proper road down which, for the duration of a person's life, that person is supposed to walk. End quote. That all made sense to me. He continued, quote, I would say that one of the major differences between Western and indigenous religions is that Aboriginal groups have never had any need for a messiah. Not only is there no need, but in fact there really is no place for one in the cosmos. I asked, why is that? He said, if the world is not a veil of tears, there's no need for salvation. Indians know nothing of a wholly different world, a heaven, compared to which this world is devoid of value. Indian religion is instead concerned with, as anthropologist Robert N. Bella noted, the maintenance of personal, social, and cosmic harmony and with attaining specific goods, rain, harvest, children, health, as people always have been. A commonality among all civilized religions is that of transcendence. But what I'm trying to get at is that in the North American Indian tradition, individuals do not transcend themselves. They simply learn additional things about the single reality that confronts them. I think there are some very important questions we need to ask about religion and the dominant culture. Why do Western European peoples, and by extension before them the Near Eastern peoples, need a messiah? Why is their appraisal of the physical world a negative one? Why do their societies suffer such perennial and continuing crises? Why do they insist on believing that ultimate reality is contained in another, almost unimaginable realm beyond the senses and beyond the span of human life? I don't understand it, he said. Religion, as I've experienced it, isn't the recitation of beliefs, but a way of helping us to understand our lives. It must, I think, have an intimate connection with the world in which we live, and any religion that promotes other places, heaven and so on, in favor of what we have in the physical world is a delusion, a mere control device to allow us to be manipulated. I asked, what then, in the Indian perspective, is the ultimate goal of life? He said, maturity. I said, by which you mean? He said, the ability to reflect on the ordinary things of life and discover both their real meaning and the proper way to understand them when they appear in our lives. Now, I know this sounds as abstract as anything ever said by a Western scientist or philosopher, but within the context of Indian experience, it isn't abstract at all. Maturity in this context is a reflective situation that suggests a lifetime of experience as a person travels from information to knowledge to wisdom. A person gathers information, and as it accumulates and achieves a sort of critical mass, patterns of interpretation and explanation begin to appear. This is where Western science aborts the process to derive its laws and assumes that the products of its own mind are inherent in the structure of the universe. But American Indians allow the process to continue because premature analysis gives incomplete understanding. When we reach a very old age or have the capacity to reflect and meditate on our experiences, or more often have the goal revealed to us in visions, we begin to understand how the intensity of experience, the particularity of individuality, and the rationality of the cycles of nature all relate to each other. That state is maturity, and it seems to produce wisdom. We were both silent for a moment. He concluded, because Western society concentrates so heavily on information and theory, its product is youth, not maturity. The existence of thousands of plastic surgeons in America attests to the fact that we haven't crossed the emotional barriers that keep us from understanding and experiencing maturity. You may have heard the phrase, kill them all and let God sort them out. Here's where it comes from. The policy of the Catholic Church has been and continues to be nulla salus extra ecclesiam, which means outside the church there is no salvation. The statement manifests not only the eradication of diversity that characterizes our culture, but also inadvertently suggests the misery our culture leads to. Outside this oppressive culture, there is no need for salvation. Although this is still church policy, we can modernize the statement by saying, outside science, there is no knowledge. For outside technology, there is no comfort. For outside capitalism, there are no economic transactions. For outside industrial civilization, there is no humanity. Or right to the point of this book, outside the panopticon, there is no security. When those in power say that outside the church, or science, or technology, or capitalism, or civilization, or the panopticon, there can be no salvation, they're lying. What they're really saying is that you better not escape, because if you are outside of this church, your continued existence and happiness will shake their own belief in the notion that the church itself is good for them. Thus, the one who can be saved only if you remain in the church is the church itself. If you leave, it ceases to be the arbiter of all meaning and the source of salvation. The salvation of the church requires not only your belief and participation, but if you leave, it requires your death, and beyond that, your annihilation. In industry, science, religion, and other institutions, diversity must be eliminated. Thus, the constant violence done by the believers in the church, science, civilization, capitalism, whatever name the sickness goes by at that moment, against all disbelievers, whether indigenous peoples, heretics, non-humans. Early in the 13th century, Pope Innocent III gave orders of fire and sword against heretics all over Europe, collectively remembered today as Cathars. In just one French city, Béziers, 100,000 heretics known as Waldensians or Albigensians, believers in a widespread form of Gnosticism, were murdered. After the sacking of the city, the inquisitors had a few hundred captives on their hands. Although the conquerors had promised, as they so often do, that those who surrendered would be allowed to live, once their power was in place, the conquerors changed their mind, as once again they so often do. Many of their prisoners claimed to have never been heretics, but just in case they were lying, the inquisitors responded, Neca eos omnes, dies suas agnoset, Kill them all, God will know his own. They hanged 50 and burned the rest. Some scholars argue that the story is apocryphal because the phrase did not appear in any historical documents for another 60 years, and then only in a document written by someone, quote, with an ardent imagination and very little concern for historical authenticity, end quote. As one skeptic writes, no historian since 1866 has subscribed to the famous kill them all, but story writers still use it, and that is enough to prove how slow scientific acquisitions are in this regard to penetrate the public domain, end quote. Actually, what this controversy proves to me is that there are a lot of people who will feverishly construct minor arguments to distract themselves and others from seeing the larger movement of our culture. Note that the scholarly controversy isn't over whether the Catholics massacred 100,000 people in that city, which they did, but whether anyone uttered this phrase. I don't care so much about words as actions. For example, I care less about the pronouncements of clear-cutters than I do about their actions. They kill all the trees and let economics sort them out, with fiscally valuable trees going to the mill and trash trees going in the slash pile to be burned. Industrial fishing? They kill them all and do the same. Fiscally valuable fish go in the freezer. And trash fish, birds, mammals, go overboard as bycatch. And humans? Count the number of non-threatened indigenous cultures still living traditionally on their traditional homelands. If you get to one, you've gone too far. Kill them all and let God sort them out. We can alter the statement slightly and apply it to the Panopticon. The Panopticon is technology's church. Outside the church, there can be no salvation. And the word from on high is this. Monitor them all. Let God sort them out. God monitor us all.